This is Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. The podcast Suspect Convictions continues with a weird new fact about the Christina McNeil killing. Barton McNeil's ex, Masuk Wang, bought the bed on which 3-year-old Christina was killed after the murder.
I'm not surprised that she bought this bed. It was something she was holding on to here, some obsession with this.
Listen to the latest edition with Carrie Martin of the podcast White Wine True Crime and Shira Weiss of the Huffington Post. And you'll hear from an activist candidate from Springfield ready to challenge 13th District Congressman Rodney Davis. GLT's Ryan Denham talks with Angel Sides, one of 5 Democratic candidates. All of that and a GLT News update on the way. It's January 12th, 2018. This is Sound Ideas on GLT.
Support for the Sound Ideas podcast comes from listener contributions to GLT, with additional support from Country Financial Representative Justin M. Boyd. Information at justinmboyd.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. It's frankly weird for the former girlfriend of a man convicted of murdering his daughter to buy the bed on which the daughter was murdered. But that's what happened when Masuk Wang purchased the bed of Christina McNeil and gave it to her own daughter to use. It's the next episode in our ongoing presentation of the podcast, Suspect Convictions.
The following contains graphic discussions of murder and sexual violence. Listener discretion is advised.
I cannot convey any better the traumatic words that you'd hear on this 911 tape. And when I hear them today, my blood runs cold.
911, what's your emergency?
I need an ambulance. My daughter is dying, I think.
Rescue is needed. 3-year-old female child, unconscious, not breathing.
It's Christina. He is wasting away a life in a jail for a murder he didn't commit, and worse, for his own daughter, with whom he loved.
There is a whole bunch of evidence now that links Masuk to the crime scene.
There is absolutely no evidence of any forced entry, any breaking in, and according to the defendant, the only people in that house with permission were himself and Christina.
This is Suspect Convictions with investigative journalist Scott Reeder. I'm Willis Kern. We continue to review the tragic death of 3-year-old Christina McNeil in Bloomington, Illinois in 1998. And Scott, a few weeks back, we had an episode called Ask Bart, where we invited listeners to call in and interact and ask questions with Barton McNeil from his prison cell in Southern Illinois. At the time, we indicated that we were going to extend the same courtesy to prosecutors in this case. What have you heard from them?
I got an email back from Mary Cole, who's an assistant state's attorney here in McLean County, and they declined to participate in such an episode. Although they have, you know, to their credit, they agreed to be interviewed by me as we were putting this podcast together, but they didn't want to open themselves up to questions being asked by the broad audience.
We're joined today by a couple of guests that we're going to have at a podcast roundtable, and Scott, why don't you talk a little bit about who we are going to have with us today.
We have Shira Weiss. She is a true crime writer for the Huffington Post. She's done some really terrific work. I'm really excited about having her on board. And then we also have Carrie Martin, who is the co-host of White Wine True Crime, who does some really excellent work out in California looking at a variety of cases. I highly recommend the work of both of these women, and I'm looking forward to having them on the show. Shira, why don't you tell us a little bit about what you're doing with HuffPost and your other true crime endeavors?
Well, I'm actually a little bit new to the whole true crime thing. I mean, I've always watched true crime, but I recently started delving into some major cases, like the disappearance of Maura Murray. Somehow I really went down the rabbit hole of that and really explored and investigated and talked to a lot of people. Another thing that I did recently was the murder of Natalie Holloway. I spoke to Dave Holloway and really explored that case and some recent developments in that case. That was kind of a pivotal moment speaking to Dave, because you know, that's when you really, I mean, obviously these stories are not easy to cover. I have a lot of emotions. And Suspect Convictions, actually, the first time I listened to it, it was so hard to listen to because I have children. So that was just like, you know, you mentioned having daughters.
Yes.
It was so hard for me, and it still is, whenever I hear the 911 call. But I really think it's important to look into, you know, if there's a shadow of a doubt to somebody's innocence and guilt, then I really think it's important to explore that. And I love what the Innocence Project is doing. So I've recently gotten very interested in exploring all of these types of cases where I feel like there should definitely be another trial, you know. So that's how I came to true crime.
Okay. Well, if we want to read your stuff, where do we go?
Okay. So if you just put in Shira Weiss Huffington Post in Google, it will lead you straight to my archive on Huffington Post. But they can also follow me on Twitter at Shira Weiss.
We'll make it easy for our listeners. Spell your name for us, because it's not like Mary Smith.
Sure. It's Shira.
Okay.
And my last name is Weiss.
Sounds great. And Carrie, why don't you tell us about White Wine True Crime, which you are the co-host of.
Yeah, White Wine True Crime is a podcast. We say it's actually a comedy podcast, but we cover true crime topics. We used to start out by reviewing true crime shows. Then we kind of moved to documentaries, and now it's any sort of true crime articles of interest. Caitlin and I both do comedy part-time, but we've been friends for about 5 years now. We met through comedy, and we realized while we were driving together to and from shows that we liked both true crime and white wine, so we combined the two, and now we have a podcast.
Why don't you tell us who Caitlin is? You mentioned her.
Yeah, Caitlin Cutt is my co-host. She also does comedy. She's been doing it for about 5 or 6 years. So we have this podcast, Pretty White Wine True Crime. And then we have a second podcast called Pretty Scary, which covers anything that's pretty scary in the world. So it could be true crime. And it also covers things like sarin gas and political refugees and a bunch of stuff that I'm not that smart about. But through covering some of these subjects, I've come to learn a little bit more. And she's a new mom for the first time. Her baby's 3 months old.
Well, that is so cool. That is so cool. Let's talk about Suspect Convictions. I believe this is the first time either one of you have been on the show. But last week we talked about the cousins that were so committed to advocating for this relative they really hardly knew at all. One of them didn't even know he existed. The other one said he thought he'd maybe met him twice at weddings, like when he was very small. That was the extent of it. Does it surprise you that these two people have stepped forward and have become his biggest advocates?
It does seem interesting to me, but I kind of feel like it's like the case of the lottery, where all of a sudden somebody wins the lottery and then everybody starts coming out of the woodwork. So what their motive is, I'm not 100% sure. Sometimes it's just attention seeking. But yeah, why they're rallying around him now, I'm not 100% sure.
Well, I actually was thinking, I mean, I actually saw some posts by the cousin on the internet, and he's so immersed in the case. And I feel, I have a contrary opinion to that. I feel that he is like us. He's an armchair detective. He really wants to figure this out. And he has the personal connection of being related. And so naturally, I mean, if you are a sleuthing kind of person and you're intrigued by this case and this, there seems to be an injustice and you're related, there's that extra pull for you. When I saw how active he was and how he knows all the details, I was actually very impressed by that.
Yeah, I mean, it's just really fascinating to me. I mean, I'd like to think if I was ever wrongly accused of a crime, a long-lost cousin would show up and become my advocate. But, you know, the interesting thing here is I think these two cousins are really the reason the Innocence Project got involved and everybody else, because mm-hmm. you almost have to have somebody on the outside that's advocating for you to get the attention from these organizations that you need and to get things rolling for you. And actually, frankly, to do the research and get the paperwork you need from the courthouse and other places. So, yeah, I mean, I just find it fascinating that these two people felt compelled independently, really, of getting involved, because they didn't know each other either. I mean, they didn't. One didn't know Bart at all, and but neither one of them had met or even knew of the existence of the other one when they became involved in this case. So I find that really interesting. One of the questions that comes to mind is, is DNA evidence. Shira, why don't you tell us, what's your thoughts on listening to the DNA evidence that was presented?
I found that to be so fascinating because, you know, there's trace DNA, there's DNA. And I think that when this murder happened, we were still at the genesis of the whole DNA, DNA discovery movement. I think that, you know, DNA has come such a long way in recent years. And I think that Ms. Sook's DNA could have been found there as like trace DNA, like you guys mentioned, because she had been at the house so many times. I don't know how strong of a case we have with the DNA, because there are so many questions. I mean, I listened to you guys explain it, and it just seems like, yes, some skin cells may be there because she spent so much time at the house, but was she there right before the murder? We don't know. So I'm worried about how strong the DNA is here. That's my personal take.
Do you think it points towards exoneration, or do you think that it's kind of a, I'm not talking about in a court of law, but just in your own mind, does it point to exoneration, or do you think it's really kind of the six of one, half dozen of another?
I think the latter. I worry that it doesn't point to exoneration personally. I think Carrie might differ with me, but it just seems like we're not sure if this DNA is the trace DNA or if it's legitimate, you know, enough to say she was there, she broke through the screen, the window, and she committed this crime. Now, I think the fact that she went on to commit murder is very telling. I just, in a court of law, I don't know if there's enough with the DNA.
Carrie, we've talked about this, not on an episode, but we've chatted about this. Why don't you share your thoughts on the DNA?
I actually completely agree with Shira. I've actually been watching a lot of different documentaries lately, and one of them is the confession tapes on Netflix. And I think it's so easy to say, oh, like there's DNA, so it's a slam dunk case. But again, to Shira's point, you don't know, you know, did they live in the house before? You know, what exactly, how long has that DNA been there? Is it fresh? I don't know necessarily that just finding DNA anymore is a slam dunk and that it does mean a confession. And I absolutely think that Bart will need more than just this DNA evidence to have an exoneration. And again, like you were saying, we have chatted about this. Once you're convicted in a court of law, it is just so unbelievably hard to overturn. So unless something miraculous happens, I think his chances of ever getting out are slim, although I do appreciate the fact that, you know, the Illinois Innocence Project is working on it. I just know that these kind of convictions are super hard to overturn.
How about the window evidence? I mean, do you guys find that at all compelling?
This is Shira. I personally wonder, like, there are very small holes in the window if a person got in. It just, to me, the question is, like, how she was able to get in, because they're very small, very small holes. That's what it looks like. And I think it's very possible that she did. She definitely seems to be tied to this in some way, especially, I mean, so telling, again, is the fact that she went on to murder her mother-in-law. And I was actually, with regard to the window, I just wondered about that, because it didn't seem like there was enough of a tear in the screen to get in.
There was a cut in the screen above the latches. So the argument is that if somebody broke in, they would have put their fingers through the screen and opened the latches.
And then opened the window,
yes. And gotten through the window. So that's the argument here that's being made.
This is Carrie, and I just wanted, I guess, to piggyback on that. I absolutely think that it should have been investigated more with the slits and, you know, definitely possibly undoing the latches to the window and then putting it back. Is it a possibility? Yes. Also, possibly not. But with it being a murder one trial, I absolutely think it should have been investigated further. Another thing that I think was kind of glazed over is that both Bart and his ex-wife had seen Masuk's car on their street.
Right.
And that really wasn't explored a whole lot by the prosecution or the defense. It seems like they found their guy, and that's who they went after.
This comes to the case about the police conduct in the case. When you listen to those internal phone calls, you know, where the lieutenant is being talked to by the dispatcher and some others, you know, and he says, this guy keeps calling here. The dispatcher says he keeps calling here and wants somebody out. And then his daughter died this morning, and the The police lieutenant says, well, what the hell is his problem? I mean, what's your reaction to that? I mean,
this is Carrie. I think also with the small town police, you know, agencies, they just don't, they're not used to these cases. They don't necessarily understand maybe the ethics or how they're supposed to be going about them. And yeah, he sounded completely annoyed. And I think it was kind of, it's out of his scope of, you know, his everyday duties. They're not used to murder cases in his town. So I think he was ill-equipped, to be completely honest, that whole police force to deal with this case.
Now, this is Shira. I want to add to that. I think that because he was ill-equipped, I think they were very, and you see this on so many, in so many cases, I think they were so quick to find a solution to this. And that's why, you know, I think Barton was unfairly, you know, he was under scrutiny so quickly because they weren't willing to really look at the alternate possibilities. And, you know, and the whole question of sexual abuse, I think, is what sort of did Barton in, because initially, and, you know, we heard from your expert who said that that Christina's orifices may have been enlarged due to rigor mortis rather than to any penetration. And this is really hard to talk about. But I think the question at that point in time of sexual abuse is what put Barton on their radar screen and had him so quickly arrested and looked into. And I think they weren't really, in a small town where it's just so hard to grapple with all these, you know, possibilities. And, you know, maybe they just were overwhelmed by the information. I think that, you know, it was to his detriment that he was living in the small town because there was so much to look into.
And this is Carrie, to, I guess, go off what Shira was saying, but a lot of police agencies, they just want to close a case. They figure out whichever guy they literally almost want it to be. They kind of have blinders on and they want to close it. There's a lot of pressure from the media. There's a lot of pressure from, you know, the people in the town where they want to feel safe again. And they want, you know, that satisfaction of being able to say, I closed this case. I solved this crime.
You're tuned to Suspect Convictions. I'm Willis Kern, along with Scott Reeder. We're joined today via Skype by Carrie Martin, a podcaster with the podcast White Wine True Crime, and also Shira Weiss, who is a true crime reporter with the Huffington Post.
Okay, I'm going to reveal something that we haven't reported before, but I think is interesting. You know, there was this child abuse report where Masuk is accused of abusing one of her daughters. And in the report, as part of the report, there was something I thought was very strange. When Bart was arrested, obviously he had all of this stuff in his apartment, and his brother came and loaded up his stuff. And one thing he didn't have room for in his truck was Bart's bed, so he donated it to the Salvation Army. Well, this is so weird. Masuk was doing community service for domestic abuse against Bart, and she was assigned to do community service at the Salvation Army. And apparently, according to this report, she bought the bed that Christina was killed on.
Oh my God.
And gave it to her daughter to sleep in. To hear Bart say it, you know, Christina was treated Masuk's daughter, Michelle, like an older sister. I mean, they were very close. Does this strike you as odd? I mean, behavior, guys? I mean,
Well, this is Shira. I think that it just shows that Masuk is as psychotic as I think she is based on everything. I mean, what's not strange about Masuk at this point? She was dating Barton at the time of this murder, then went on to kill her mother-in-law. I wouldn't be surprised if she had some kind of fixation with what happened. She apparently, when she struck her own daughter with a paper towel rod, she said something to her like, you don't want what happened to your sister to happen to you. And sister was referring to Christina because they were, even though they weren't biologically sisters, they were close, like sisters, is what I read.
Sure.
So I think what is not bizarre about Masuk, I'm not surprised that she bought this bed, you know, that she got this bed from the Salvation Army. It to me, it just further implicates her, you know, there was something she was holding on to here, some obsession with this.
I agree. I definitely think she's psychotic. And I think and by the way, what an eerie coincidence that this matches the whole bed. I mean, if you're a psychotic, which it sounds like she definitely has those traits, I think one of the reasons she bought it is as a trophy. And they say people who murder, they look for trophies because they want to relive. And again, I'm just throwing this out of speculation, but they want to relive their crime.
But I can't imagine being a parent and giving my daughter the bed of her friend who is like a sister to her to sleep in. I mean, I just try to wrap my head around that, and it just, or for that matter, you know, it was the bed of the guy that she had claimed had killed the daughter too. I mean,
it's, well, more than that, I don't understand why it wasn't just thrown away.
Yeah.
This is Shira. I just want to say that it's interesting because for a little bit I wondered, could Bart be guilty and it be like a, you know, a birds of a feather flock together, like he's guilty of something and she's guilty of something, you know, because what are the chances of two people that hang out together being murderers? Then I was thinking, you know, well, maybe like bad attracts bad and he is guilty of something. I mean, these are all the initial thoughts that were going through my head. But hearing more and more about Masuk and this latest revelation, it just convinces me that there's a lot. I mean, there's obviously a background with her. A lot of things in her life have caused her to be this seemingly evil person or this messed up person. And, you know, I really think that, you know, I mean, I worried about Bart initially because I heard about the possible sexual abuse. But then hearing your expert explain that there may not have been any sexual abuse, mm-hmm. It just further convinced me that he was just basically, you know, framed by Masuk because he was alone with Christina and she did such a great job of committing this murder and, you know, not coming under scrutiny by the police at the time.
Well, again, with what Shira is saying, they thought it was an accident that she had, I believe, died in her sleep. And it wasn't until Barton said that he thought that she was murdered that they even started looking into it.
The point you made, Carrie, about birds of the feather flock together, that's crossed my mind, too, because, you know, I've been a reporter for a long time. It's not uncommon for people with the same tendency just to hang out together. I mean, Jason Chambers said he's the prosecutor here in McLean County. He said to me once, you know, sometimes don't you see a couple that's together and that they're both nuts and you think they just deserve each other? That was the analogy he used. But on the other hand, there's been nothing before or since this crime that points to Bart. It says that he has behaved in a mentally unstable way. I mean, he hasn't been arrested. He hasn't gotten in trouble in prison. He hasn't done any of these things. On the other hand, Masuk, she'd had domestic violence problems before the Christina's death. She went on, of course, after the death to murder her mother-in-law. When you talk to her ex-husband, she talks about how violent she was. We talked to Bart. He talks about how violent she was. We know, obviously, that she's a killer. I mean, there's a lot of things there we know. And it just kind of raises a lot of questions in my mind, to be honest with you.
This is Carrie. To your first point, I think that sometimes the birds of a feather stick together. There are shows that cover that. There's Snap Killer Couples. There's Wicked Attraction about, you know, couples that possibly have these underlying tendencies. And when they're together, they become this explosive couple, and then they go on these rampages. But I don't believe this was like a rampage killing. I think with Masuk being a psychopath or sociopath or whatever classification it is, a lot of them are very charming. So it probably wasn't revealed to Bart until they were into their relationship. She probably showed him the best side of her. And then as their relationship continued, the real Masuk came out, and that led to their breakup.
Yeah, and this is Shira again. I think that Bart's only crime was dating Masuk. Because when you get caught up, I mean, and I think that Christina's mom blames, from what I read, she seems to blame Barton because he was dating Masuk and it happened, this happened under his watch. And that's, at the end of the day, you know, the mother is like a, it's like an employer, you know, I don't care how it happened under your watch. And I think that, you know, that was his biggest, the thing that was the most to his detriment was the fact that he was involved with Masuk in the first place. And, you know, he has gotten some criticism for the fact that she's been accused of domestic violence, and he knew that she was a problematic person. To what extent, we don't really know, and I don't think he knew that she was capable of the things she would go on to do.
One of the things that really bothers me here and this is more of a moral issue rather than a legal issue, but his wife was pregnant, and he began this affair with Masuk, and then almost as soon as the child's born, he leaves his wife, and he has Masuk move in with him. I mean, that doesn't speak too well of Bart, I mean, in that context. I mean, what are you ladies' opinion on that?
This is Carrie. I think just because he has poor moral judgment, it doesn't make him a killer. I agree. It was awful timing and probably not the best move. And it's not going to help his case, you know, in the eyes of the law when, you know, the prosecution's going after him to get him for murder one. Again, I don't think that is a killer make. I just think it shows that he probably doesn't have the best moral compass.
And this is Shira. This comes up all the time on Dateline episodes and things like that, where a person could be a cheater, but that doesn't make them a killer. And I feel like this is a recurrent theme. Carrie and I know Josh Mankiewicz, and he covers a lot of these types of cases on the show. And it's brought up time and again, just because someone cheats, just because someone is bad with relationships or does the wrong things with relationships, that does not make the whole other level of evil to be a killer. I was so caught up on the sexual abuse stuff initially that I thought Barton might be guilty. But, you know, now so much more evidence has come to light. I really just think it was unfortunate that he was involved with Masuk. It was the fact that he was cheating on his wife was bad, but not to the level of evil that killing is. And so I really think that a person who cheats is not indicative of whether they'll go on to commit murder. It just doesn't sound, by all accounts, he sounds like he was a loving father.
Yes. One of the questions, though, that comes to mind is, can you understand why Christina's mother might not be particularly forgiving towards Bart? I mean, obviously he's the guy who cheated on her while she was pregnant, and then he's the person that brought Masuk into Christina's life, and he continued to have her around even when she got abusive towards him. I mean, would it be understandable in you guys' eyes that there might be some anger or animosity there?
Oh, absolutely. This is Carrie. I know when my parents got a divorce, I was 15, and you know, my father had left, and my mother was so upset, but he had left behind work shirts for me to iron. And I came home, and she had literally did like a one woman waiting to exhale, where she like cut them up and like put them in the yard and burned them, just because, I mean, you just don't mess with a woman scorned.
That's hilarious. It's Shira. Well, I didn't know that happened with you, but I mean, that's exactly. I think that Masuk was a woman scorned, and that's what happened there. But with regard to Christina's mother, I wonder, does she really blame Barton? I was trying to find that out. I actually asked Carrie that before our call. Or is it a matter of like, he shouldn't have been involved with Masuk, and she believes that involvement is what led to this?
We don't know, because, you know, I went and knocked on her door, and I've written her letters, and she's not talking. So I don't know what's going through Christina's mother's mind.
And this is Shira. I feel that it would be helpful to hear from her. She could attest to Barton's character. If she could let us know, you know what, he was a really great father. He did X, Y, and Z. He was a good husband to me up until the point that he cheated or whatever. If she was able to say anything, I think it would help his case a lot.
But, I mean, what would be her motive to help him out? She's a woman scorned, like she doesn't have any dogs in this fight. And you never know how anybody is going to deal with grief. I mean, at the end of the day, she's a grieving mother. If it were me, I would be more focused on the fact that even if she helps her ex who cheated on her get out of jail, like her daughter is never coming back. And I know that everybody handles grief differently. I know when I'm upset, I shut down. So I feel like if I were in her shoes, and, you know, Scott was contacting me, if I didn't have to go out of my way, you know, to make statements or be in the limelight, I probably wouldn't.
Yeah, but Shira, again, I think that, you know, she may be really angry about the cheating, but when it comes to murder, if you're looking at things more critically, I think you get over, like, there is a time period where you get over the extent of how you're hurt by the cheating. I mean, so the fact that she lost her daughter may have really just impacted her anger with Barton. And I think that, you know, if we were able to hear from her, I think it might, either way, it would shed some clarity on this, on the character of the person in question, Barton McNeil.
What do you think is the biggest mystery or the biggest missing link in this case?
For me, this is Carrie, and I've said it in the past. I think it's very interesting that it wasn't explored more, that there was a sighting by Bart and his ex-wife of Mistook's car on their street the night of the murder, and I believe it was right after Bart and Mistook had gotten into this big fight. Why that wasn't explored more, to me, that's the biggest mystery.
Yeah, I think the biggest detriment of this case is the passage of time and the fact that things weren't acted on quickly. In addition to spotting her car, I think what I read, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, is that somebody spotted Mistook in a storage closet near his residence before the murder, around the time that the murder took place. So the fact that there were sightings in general, that should have been looked at the time. And now, you know, we have the passage of so many years. I think the DNA evidence should have been looked at the time. Maybe we would, you asked me about the DNA evidence, perhaps we would have seen stronger evidence and we would have better results if it had been tested right away. I don't know.
In fairness to the Bloomington police, this murder happened in 1998. This was in the infancy of really DNA testing. You couldn't do touch DNA testing then. They did a little bit, some rudimentary testing of hairs and stuff for DNA at the time, but and they just found Christina's hair. So, I don't know what more they could really have done at that time in the area of DNA, but it does raise some interesting questions. I mean, it just strikes me as curious that within literally hours of having the autopsy result the day after the murder, they arrest Bart.
Right.
And the evidence against him is essentially proximity. He was home with her when she died, and unless somebody broke into the place, there's no other suspect.
That's... I think at the end of the day, this is Carrie. I mean, during a trial, the proof of burden is on the prosecution. But at the end of the day, and whenever a jury is, you know, sequestered or asked questions about why they made whatever verdict they did, it's typically whether they believe strongly. You know, maybe they thought Bart was innocent, but it depends on who put on, literally, who had the better game, the prosecution or the defense. And it just so happened that the prosecution won.
This is Shira. The fact that they didn't allow any mention of Mistook, they didn't allow the invoking of like an alternate suspect, it just really does not sit well with me because, you know, then she went on to do something so horrible, which shows a certain personality. If she's capable of that type of a brutal murder, then she's definitely capable of, you know, I was thinking that smothering and strangling are so similar. She strangled her mother-in-law. It's so telling that she could have smothered Christina. And it was just really to the jury's, you know, to the detriment of that trial that you know, Mistook, that no mention of Mistook was made.
And this is Carrie. She might have smothered Christina because she was younger. You know, it's harder to tell. It could have been an accidental death where Christina would have been too young and too weak to fight back, where with the mother-in-law, she would have had to strangle her over smother her just because the mother-in-law would have been stronger and could have fought back.
If you guys were sitting on a jury for a second trial, would you vote based on the evidence that's been presented in the podcast for acquittal or for conviction?
Shira, I would definitely, I'm ready to acquit him now because I know that as a jury, you can't say, oh, because she committed this murder, we need, you know, that can't be your reasoning. But I think there's just so much doubt. There's so much reasonable doubt. And the fact that Mistook went on to do what she did to her mother-in-law, and the fact that the evidence is just not strong linking Barton to this.
Right.
There's just, because of reasonable doubt, I would acquit.
I would also acquit. But that's if all of the information that I know about Mistook was entered into evidence and, you know, we were able to know the Mistook, I guess, angle, 100% I would acquit.
Anything you want to ask, Willis?
Maybe to take it one step further, do each of our guests believe that Christina died at the hands of Mistook then? I would gather that that's their implication by what they just said.
Yeah, this is Carrie. I'm going off everything that I've read and the other information I've gotten from your podcast. Absolutely, it sounds like a murder, and just going, I guess, off my gut and the information that I know, I do feel that Mistook murdered her.
And this is Shira. I agree with Carrie. if it's conclusive from the autopsy result that she was smothered, then I think, you know, absolutely Miss Sook did this and she smothered her. When I first listened to the first episode, I thought it could have been natural causes. But I mean, a three-year-old does not die of, as Aphrodite Jones mentioned, a three-year-old doesn't die of SIDS. A three-year-old doesn't typically just, a healthy three-year-old does not just die. And it seems that the autopsy results really indicated that it was a smothering. So based on what was going on with Miss Sook, the fact that she has a pattern of being a woman scorned who wants to retaliate, I mean, that's what she did with her, with the husband who, you know, whose mother she killed. There's a pattern there of, you rejected me, now you pay the price. And I really do feel that's what happened in this case.
Hey, I really want to thank both of you for joining us. It's really an honor to have you participate.
You're tuned to Suspect Convictions. I'm Willis Kern, along with Scott Reeder. We're joined today via Skype by Carrie Martin, a podcaster with the podcast White Wine True Crime, and also Shira Weiss, who is a true crime reporter with the Huffington Post. Scott, we do want to mention one thing. You had alluded in the course of the conversation with Carrie and Shira that you asked their opinions about how they thought that Barton McNeil might be found based on the evidence that we have uncovered during the run of Suspect Convictions. We should point out also that's probably very likely to be different than any evidence that could be presented at a trial, if there is one.
Yeah, and I think that's a big, big if there is a trial. I mean, it's very hard to get a new trial in a case like this. But if there were a new trial, certainly the rules of evidence are much different in a courtroom than they are in a newsroom. So what I can present in a podcast may be quite different than what a judge allows before a jury for consideration.
Next week during Suspect Convictions, we'll ask the questions that we did a few weeks ago, who is Miss Sook? We'll be asking, who is Barton McNeil?
And we're very excited about this. We got a variety of people from Bart's life that are talking about him and telling us about him.
That's next week during Suspect Convictions. Special thanks to Colin Thompson, WGLT General Manager R.C. McBride, and the production staff of Sound Ideas, including Mike McCurdy, Charlie Schlenker, and Ryan Denham. With investigative journalist and Suspect Convictions creator Scott Reeder, I'm Willis Kern. We'll see you next week on Suspect Convictions.
Hear new episodes of Suspect Convictions during Sound Ideas each Friday on GLT, Bloomington Normal's only locally owned and operated broadcast media outlet.
Support for GLT's Sound Ideas comes from Country Financial Representative Justin M. Boyd, helping individuals and families create solid plans for the future through a combination of investment options and life insurance. Information at justinmboyd.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
Hey, this is Chris from Knoxville. Just wanted to call, leave a voicemail, and let you know how much I appreciate Bullseye. It's a show that really gets to the heart of things quickly.
I'm Jesse Thorne. This week, the legendary filmmaker Errol Morris joins me in the studio, plus Meryl Garbus from the band Tune Yards on the song that changed her life. On the next Bullseye for MaximumFun.org and NPR. Join me tomorrow at 11 a.m. on GLT. News and ideas.
Support for GLT comes from Brad Barker Honda, working with car buyers to match them with quality, reliable vehicles suited to their lifestyles and budgets. Veterans Parkway and GE Road in Bloomington or online at bradbarkerhonda.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
It's Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. There is a fifth Democrat looking to challenge Congressman Rodney Davis. She's Angel Sides, a substitute teacher from Springfield, a late entry into the Democratic primary in the 13th Congressional District, a district that includes parts of Bloomington Normal. Sides is a first-time candidate but has been involved in politics and campaigns for years. Her progressive platform echoes that of Bernie Sanders, who she campaigned for in 2016. Sides says her number one concern is the role of for-profit media in shaping public debate over important issues like universal health care.
Because we have media sponsored by corporations. Corporations won't tell or report on things that affect their bottom line. So, you know, they're not given the fair view of what for example, universal health care is. We have insurance companies that lobby politicians and they sponsor the media. People can consider that corporate America is the media. They're not going to put a positive light on universal health care because insurance companies have so much invested in our media and our politicians. But that's something every other civilized country has. I mean, when the common voter asks themselves, how are we different than any other country that has this? We're not. We're the richest country in the world. And we are stressing out our sick. We're stressing out our elderly. You know, it's about time this country has universal single-payer health care. And you can call it expanding Medicare. But we need to get there because it's ridiculous. We don't have it already, in my opinion.
So other than universal single-payer health care, what are the other top issues that you're going to be pushing through the campaign?
I think tuition-free college education. We have predatory lending. Young people deserve an education without going into debt because some of them, you know, they might change their major. They might not be able to get a good job when they're out of college, and that interest piles up, and they're worse off than if they'd have never gone to school at all, and that's not right because, once again, there's countries, you know, in Europe that have free college education, and why is that? And we don't have it. It just seems like when you really look at the big picture, we have 56% of our discretionary spending going towards defense, and that's you can add up all the defense spending of countries like the United Kingdom, Japan, Germany, France, Russia, China. You can add those all up, and we're more than double that amount for our defense spending. It's our money, and it should be used on the American people to update our infrastructure and for education, maybe to house a homeless person, to convert to alternative energy.
Angel, you've been involved with political activism for at least a decade, and I know you mentioned you volunteered for the Bernie Sanders presidential campaign in 2016. Have you yourself ever run for office before or held office?
No, I've been representing people through my activism and also running campaigns for other politicians.
Who are some of your political heroes, office holders, past or present, that you look up to?
I've been just campaigning for Democrats because when you follow the money, we have the biggest corporatist party is the Republicans. We have some corporate Democrats. That's why I campaigned for Bernie Sanders. I'm under the notion we need to transform the Democratic Party before it's too late. Even Jimmy Carter has come out and said we live in an oligarchy. But, and so I campaigned for Ann Callis. I've campaigned for Dick Durbin. I usually agree, you know, with Dick Durbin. He's pretty good. I've campaigned for David Gill, believe it or not, a little. I have always campaigned for a Democrat. I probably would have campaigned for Bernie Sanders if he would have ran as an independent, but everyone said, oh, you know, he wouldn't have won. And it shouldn't be that way in this country. We've got a lot of things we've got to change, from the superdelegates to the fact that we don't have an open primary here in this state, to maybe the Electoral College as well.
So how would you grade Rodney Davis's tenure in Congress so far?
Oh, gosh. He votes against clean water. I mean, it's just a typical Republican. You know, he doesn't hold a town hall unless you donate a lot of money to his campaign. And that's part of the reason I'm running. I just have been so angry because you have no voice in this country. You can have tens of thousands of people marching in the streets, and it's not even reported in the media. There's just no forum for people to hear your voice. What is he afraid of? That's what you have to ask yourself. If somebody can't meet with you and hear a question and answer a question that hasn't been selected or, you know, somehow scripted for someone to give, that's That's not democracy. We should have a voice in any forum. Like, we should be able to speak, and people should be able to clap if they like you. And if they like what you say, it just seems like we've lost our freedom of speech in this country.
This is GLT's Sound Ideas. I'm Ryan Denham. I'm speaking with Angel Sides, a Democrat running for the 13th Congressional District that's currently held by Republican incumbent Rodney Davis. The 13th Congressional District is pretty sprawling. It stretches here from Bloomington Normal to the east towards Champaign-Urbana to the south near you in Springfield and Taylorville, where Congressman Davis is from. This is a district that Republicans have held, but one in which Democrats think they can possibly steal away in 2018. So what does a Democrat like you have to do to actually win this district next year?
Well, just get out and talk to constituents. We need to expose Rodney Davis. I'm telling people right now to follow the money. Look how his campaign is financed. And then you want to look also at, you know, when you vote for someone, how long have they been saying what they're saying? In other words, if they're just now saying, for example, let's raise the minimum wage, then they're probably pandering to the voter instead of actually believing in that, or they'll be less likely to take action to make that happen. But what we really need are people that will not sell out to corporate America at any cost. You know, you just go in there. Don't even plan on being reelected. Don't go there trying to get campaign donations from industry. Just do your job for 2 years and get out. That's what we need. We need people planning on just being there for their term and no longer, because that would change everything. That would transform the Democratic Party.
Well, you've mentioned your concerns with the influence of corporations in our elections. But how do you plan to raise enough money to stay competitive in this race, both against your Democratic primary opponents, four of them, and then against Congressman Davis, who obviously has a pretty significant fundraising advantage?
Well, I would hope that I could get, if I were nominated, I would get funding from Our Revolution or Brand New Congress or maybe the Justice Democrats, because they have the same ideology. They're taking money, small amounts of money, from the public, just the voters themselves. And that's what needs to happen. If we subsidize anything, we need to subsidize our media and our elections. That's where some of our tax dollars should go. Not to Israel. What is that doing in Israel? What exactly are we funding in Israel with $8 million a day? What exactly is this 56% of our tax dollars going for defense? For defense for what? I mean, the statistics are, if we hadn't invaded Iraq, we would be better off and safer than if we went in like we did. So that was a big waste of our tax dollars. In fact, it made things worse with our tax dollars. You know, we need to push to subsidize our elections and our media.
So what do you think that you can offer Democratic voters that the other four Democrats in this primary cannot?
Well, I can offer them that I haven't taken money from corporations, and I haven't, and I would just plan on serving two terms, not have to try and get a bunch of money from corporate American industry to be reelected. But yeah, I don't think any other candidate is saying that. I don't think any other candidate talks about perpetual war and the need to end all these wars all over the world. So we have a little funding and we're not just getting worse off and worse off with our infrastructure and educating young people and having more and more homeless people in this country.
That's Angel Sides of Springfield, a candidate for the 13th Congressional District. She's a Democrat running in the primary against four other Democrats for a seat currently held by Republican Rodney Davis. I'm Ryan Denham.
The other four Democrats in the 13th district race are Jonathan Ebel of Urbana, David Gill of Bloomington, Eric Jones from Edwardsville, and Betsy Dirksen-Londrigan of Springfield. All five candidates will gather for a GLT Congressional Candidate Forum on February 6th at 6 p.m. at the Normal Theater in Uptown. The primary election is March 20th. Thanks for choosing Sound Ideas on WGLT Normal, made possible with listener contributions at WGLT.org. Our website is where you can find the full Sound Ideas podcast and the individual stories and interviews from Willis Kern, Scott Reeder, and Ryan Denham. Let us know what you think of Sound Ideas and Suspect Convictions. Post comments at facebook.com/WGLTFM. Our email address is news@WGLT.org. And you can always tweet about the show. Use the hashtag Sound Ideas. We're all at WGLT News. And my Twitter address is @MikeMcCurdy. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org, Bloomington Normal's public media.